This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Adam Mayer. Adam, it was a great meeting up with you in San Francisco.
Yeah, it was great meeting you when you came up for your trip to the Bay Area, and thank you for having me on again.
And you gave me an architectural tour for the day.
Right, yeah, mostly around downtown San Francisco. We got to see some of the older greats and some the newer architecture as well.
And I'm also joined here with Matthew Pegas. And Matt, you visited the Bay Area for the first time this summer. What were some of your initial impressions?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks for having me, Robert. And in terms of my impressions of San Francisco and the Bay Area in general, as I was just explaining to Adam, just really loved it. Easily one of my that and New York City. It's hard to compare to New York City, but those are by far my two favorite American cities that I've been to, and I'm pretty sure my mind wouldn't be changed if I visited other ones. Yeah, just really a marvel of urban planning, and I also love the way that the kind of green areas are interspersed with the cities up there.
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of my two favorite American cities probably being San Francisco and New York. I also do like LA. I kind of take a contrarian view on this, especially as someone who's born and raised in the Bay Area. I actually went to college at USC down in LA, which is pretty close to downtown. And the problem with LA is that when it started developing, it was a very transit-friendly, walkable area, starting with downtown. But after World War II, when the post-war boom happened and the suburban expansion happened and the ripping out of the rail car lines and expansion of the freeways, the urbanism took a turn for the worse.
Yeah, no, and we kind of see that today, I guess. And it's interesting because that theme is explored in the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, I love that. As the evil plot of the kind of comic villain, but it's interesting because you can really see that how LA is all, you know, I mean, again, there's great areas. I'm not trying to like shit on the whole city, but just the way that it's intersected with freeways everywhere, you can really tell how that kind of took a toll.
I'm pretty optimistic though about the future of LA, especially with the expansion of all the public transportation and the construction of a lot of new multifamily housing, and just kind of you can feel the energy in LA. It's about to shift away from being just about the car to being more about more walkable urban areas. And there are pockets in the vastness of LA that are nice and walkable and urban. And I think if development is concentrated around those areas, such as Koreatown, downtown LA, and those kind of areas, LA can definitely come into its own. I still have hope for it.
I mean, it'll never be like New York or San Francisco in the sense of a centralized city, but it will be decentralized and urban. I mean, can you think of any global cities that fit that model in the sense they're urban but also decentralized like LA?
Oh, that's a great question, actually.
Maybe, would you say London is much more compact than LA, but they have the West End and the city and the financial district to some degree, but I think LA is totally unique.
Yeah, well, I lived in Beijing for 1 year, actually, and even though there's the historic center with the Forbidden City and Tiananmen Square and all that, the city's development since China opened up in the early 80s, and the urban growth has concentrically grown out from the center. Since the center is a historic zone, there's not really much development happening in there. It's still pretty low-rise, but in rings around the center of Beijing, you have all this really high-density development, high-rises everywhere, and really now really good public transit subway system. So in a way, that's pretty decentralized. There's different pockets throughout the city. Even though it technically has a historic center, the historic center doesn't really function as more than just a tourist attraction today.
So when we met up in San Francisco, the basically initial meeting point of our itinerary was the atrium at the Hyatt Hotel at the Embarcadero Center.
Right, the Hyatt Embarcadero, right, the John Portman classic.
And Matt, you've also been there.
Yeah, no, I have. That was one of the highlights of my trip for sure. But you're saying you guys met up in the lobby there?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Matt, you were telling me your friend you met up with who lives in the Bay Area, he actually didn't care for it as much.
Yeah, he didn't. First of all, I just want to say it seems very fitting that you guys met in the lobby of that. That's nice. But I was with my friend who kind of has more classical tastes in things. I would say very classical European taste in just about everything. And he really didn't like the Embarcadero. I didn't think he would. I mean, he's the type of person who, I can't tell you how many times I've sat through his like lectures on how much he hates modern art and any of those kinds of aesthetics. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't like it, but I was taking, dozens and dozens of photos, so we weren't on the same page, but I think he just thought it was kind of tacky.
So the first thing is just the sheer size of it, that the grand atrium, and Matt and I were at the Bonaventure, which I guess they're both spectacular buildings, but the Bonaventure is more kind of I describe it as maze-like. The Hyatt atrium is just this one massive atrium that kind of feels like this inverted pyramid. Then you have the external glass elevators, which are a signature aspect of any work by Portman. And then you have these interesting, you have the sculpture, and then you have the light displays where the wall, I think there's that fountain there where it changes different colors. But Adam, did they renovate it at some point? Because I've seen the little pictures where it looked different.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they did some work to the lobby space in that grand atrium. I don't think that's the original design. Obviously, the floor pattern is original. I actually think the sculpture is original as well. But some of the bar area and reception zone, I don't think, is the original design, which is okay. I think it's still a very good Portman experience. I also love the Bonaventure in L.A. It's a different experience, you're right. It's kind of maze-like. But it's just, in both the Hyatt and the Bonaventure, you just feel this sense of dynamism and being overwhelmed by the experience of the architecture. It's not, especially the Bonaventure, it's been criticized for not being functional. You get kind of disoriented and you get lost. But that's also the cool part about it,
Yeah, they even have, I believe, these weird, tags and signs on the wall in the Bonaventure that are supposed to help you find your way around, but even those don't quite do the trick.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually what makes it a fun place to explore. And it's very hard to find new architecture that fits that mold. I'm sure if you go to a lot of these medieval palaces in Europe, you have those attributes. But those kind of qualities are very, basically, hard to find in American architecture from the 20th century.
Well, now the thing about Portman's work is that he used a lot of concrete, and you could almost classify his buildings as brutalism in a way. Now, brutalism is kind of having a renaissance in the design and architecture communities, but generally speaking, the public at large, at least in the U.S., doesn't find brutalism to be attractive. They actually find it to be ugly, I guess, and not aesthetically pleasing. But Portman was different in the sense that I thought that he uses concrete very skillfully. It's almost very sculptural. Remember that ramp we saw Robert, when you were walking through the Embarcadero Center, and it was
first enter from the waterfront.
Yeah, exactly. It's just it's not the most functional way to get from one level to another, but it's an experience, and I can appreciate that. These days, the trend in architecture is to use, especially in large commercial buildings and high rises, is to use all glass.
Yeah, and the architect it's brutalism, but it's a kind of glitzier brutalism. But the architect Perea, who designed the Transamerica Pyramid Tower in SF, that's also kind of brutalist. And he's done other buildings that are much more brutalist.
Yeah, for sure. Like I think I mentioned last time, maybe the library at UC San Diego that Pereira did. It's really cool.
And I also think the Embarcadero has practical functions because basically, it serves as an urban oasis, and also the practical functions of being able to walk across the street without having to be stuck in traffic.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's good for the workers, but as we saw when we were there on a Sunday, it was pretty dead. There were really no pedestrians walking up there. But as I mentioned, on the weekdays when all the workers are in the office towers, there's more going on. So and if you talk to hardcore urbanists, they would say that's a failure.
But I also think it's, it's seen as kind of a lot of traditionalists, as Matt pointed out with his friend, hates that aesthetic and Portman's work. But I think there are actually some similarities between Portman's work and ancient architecture and medieval cities.
Oh, sure. Totally. Actually, there was probably one of the most well-regarded architects of the 20th century by architects is this architect named Louis Kahn. I don't know if you guys have heard of him, but he only did maybe 8 to 10 buildings in his life that were built, and they use concrete very skillfully, and they're very heavy but also spiritual in a way. And he was very inspired by ancient monuments and kind of ancient architecture, which is very interesting. He was one of the few modernists that really was inspired by antiquity.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at some of his work right now. They almost remind me of M.C. Escher drawing.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, he did the one. He also did a building down at UC San Diego called the Salk Institute, which is amazing.
One thing that's interesting about Portman, you pointed out, is because he was both an architect and a real estate developer.
Correct.
He was able to implement his own aesthetic visions.
Yeah, right. He was his own client, so he didn't have to answer to anybody else. And if you talk to any practicing architect who has developer clients, you'll know that the ultimate decisions are made by the people with the money. So Portman was in a unique position in that regard.
So you're an architect. Can you talk about how you kind of do you feel this pressure to go for a particular aesthetic? And if you were, say, a real estate developer, what would be like your fantasy of what you would design if you could describe that?
I mean, generally, I would say that my work in the past and now is rooted in the modernist tradition of clean lines, minimalism, functionality. If I were to, you know, be my own client and do development, I kind of have this dream of, personally, I love towers, I love high-rise buildings, I love large commercial work, which is mostly what I've focused on in my career. But as you guys probably know, there's a housing crisis in San Francisco and LA and in other cities around the country as well. And I feel like most Americans still hold on to this ideal of the single family detached home with the yard. And if I were to be a developer and do my own development, I'd like to reimagine what you can do with the single family lot in terms of densifying it. And that would be developing what is known as the missing middle housing that we don't see much of these days. We either see the single family house or the large scale high rise or dense condo development with dozens of units. I'm talking more about duplexes, triplexes, row housing, courtyard housing. We don't really see a lot of that these days. We saw more of that in like the earlier 20th century in American cities, but after World War II, that type of housing went out of fashion. I would like to see a return to that.
Hmm. Yeah, because skyscrapers are, I mean, they're exciting because they make a mark on the skyline, but they're also incredibly expensive to build.
Right. And
if you're thinking about it practically, that's if you want to increase the housing supply. If you could say zone an area from single family homes to duplexes, I think that would address the housing crisis as long as there's aesthetic standards. Because because I'm just thinking about the kind of area where I grew up in. I grew up in the Westwood area of LA, and I saw like a lot of it was not so much single family homes, but there were a lot of these older duplexes that were built in the 1920s, and they were replaced by these about 4 to 5 story condominiums that were kind of pretty bland and boxy.
Yeah, the problem is after World War II, the front of the house of single family homes became all about the car. So the front facade of new homes, especially developer driven tract development in the suburbs, was you had the garage, the car garage, took the prominence of the facade. As opposed to pre-World War II single-family homes, you had nice entry porches. You know, you knew your neighbors. Actually, in my hometown, Los Gatos, which you know, Robert, where my parents live is one of the oldest neighborhoods in town. It's near downtown Los Gatos, and it's called the Almond Grove. And most of those homes were built in the 1930s as part of for wealthy San Franciscans to have vacation homes during the summer. And there's a series of alleys that go in between each street, so you actually park your car in the alley in the back, so there are no like front garages facing the main streets, and it just makes the streets so much nicer without just seeing these garage, curb cut.
Oh yeah, for sure. Back to Portman, we did visit John C. Portman's other hotel, that's the JW Marriott, a few blocks west of Union Square. And, I mean, that's not as on the same, it's not of the same caliber of the Hyatt in the Embarcadero complex, or Embarcadero Center, but it does have an impressive atrium, and it does have some interesting architectural features. So the external glass elevators, they have this kind of almost, they're brass, and they have this kind of industrial, almost like kind of a retro type quality. And then the entrance is this kind of, it's kind of faux deco, so there are some interesting architectural features. And then there's also a cool sculpture.
Yeah, the interior is pretty cool. It's obviously not as interesting or dynamic as the Hyatt Embarcadero or the Bonaventure, but once you're inside, it's a pretty interesting space. You know, I don't know if you saw the Portman documentary that I sent you, but I just rewatched the other day, and that particular building, the JW Marriott near Union Square in San Francisco, actually almost bankrupted John Portman, because it opened in 1989, right around the time the Loma Prieta earthquake happened. So tourism dropped precipitously in San Francisco, and also there was a financial crisis, and he had funded that whole project on his own dime. So I don't know if there were corners cut in the end. It's still a pretty impressive atrium, nonetheless. I would say the biggest downfall of that building is the entry, and it's kind of hard to get into. You have to walk through the car drop-off area to enter into the lobby, which is one of the biggest criticisms of Portman's buildings in general, is that the entry is always hard, difficult to find.
So his later work was mostly in Asia, especially China. Would you say the 70s, and most of his American work was in the 70s and 80s?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, after the late 80s and into the early 90s, he just he was a very shrewd businessman. He was one of the first American architects and developers to make connections to China and do work over there. And I'm familiar with some of his work in Shanghai and Beijing, and it's really great. It's pretty awesome. It's Portman style, but it incorporates Chinese themes and motifs, and it's really well done.
And I know in urbanism there is this obsession with street life,
right?
But I think it's really crucial to have urban oases. When urban oases can be a place like the Embarcadero Center, but it can also be these places you find in small towns and suburbs that are these areas where you go through maybe an arcade, and then you have a courtyard and a fountain. So, I mean, that's a tradition that goes way back, but I think it's really important to have these urban oases. But in urbanism, there's this obsession, like everything has to be on street level. Like, what do you think is the origin of that obsession?
That's a good question. In the early 90s also is when new urbanism really came to prominence. And I know you've interviewed James Howard Kunstler in the past.
Oh, he absolutely detests Portman.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure he hates Portman. He hates big cities with high rises. He kind of is nostalgic for this quaint American ideal of the main street, which, you know, it's pleasant, but I think he's a little bit of an alarmist. But, you know, I read his book, The Geography of Nowhere, when I was a college student, and I do have to say he has a lot of really good points in there, especially about suburban sprawl and exurban development and how that was just pretty egregious. I don't really think, especially exurban sprawl, really has a future in the 21st century. But I do disagree with Kunstler's characterization of high-density like skyscraper development, especially when you go to cities like or in Asia, like in Japan or Korea or China, you can see that you can still have a very active and bustling street life and still have skyscrapers everywhere.
Well, I think the key to making high density more livable is these urban oases, because if you have a high population density and everything is on street level, then it's going to be really overwhelming. But if you have sky bridges, walkways, areas with a garden and a fountain, and more kind of communal space, that those are ways to make density more livable.
Yeah, back to Portman. I mean, when he did the Hyatt Embarcadero, and we did the Bonaventure, and he did the Marriott Marquis and Times Square in New York, the areas where these hotels were built were not, it was not a pleasant place to be outside. It was actually pretty scary and dangerous. So he brought the urbanism inside, and given the time, if you look at the history and given the time that these were built, I think it was pretty progressive and interesting idea.
I remember speaking of Portman and the outside of some of these buildings being unpleasant places to be when they were originally built. I do remember reading something that compared a lot of Portman's work, the Bonaventure in particular, to sort of like fortresses almost, where the idea was that you were somehow deflecting the outside world and kind of, you know, creating a very robust concrete space to get yourself away from it.
Oh, because that was kind of in response to the crime wave of the 70s and 80s. And I kind of, I've also interviewed that guest about, who talks a lot about the history of Times Square, and he doesn't, another reason some people don't like Portman is because his work was associated with these urban renewal projects, which probably replaced a historic architecture. So some people dislike the idea. They say they're these urban fortresses that are closed off, but that's not really how I see it. I see it as, there's sometimes maybe a little bit difficult to find, but I really like that sense of exploration.
Yeah, there's certainly experiences, and you certainly feel as if when you're in them that you're somewhere very different than you were when you were outside.
And, one area in San Francisco I'll point out is there's this area called South Park, and my friend and I were driving in traffic after the Giants game got out, and there was just really bad traffic jam. But my observations is I think that area has been poorly planned out because, as I said, with a lot of Portman's work in the financial district, that creates a really pleasant pedestrian experience. My critique of the South Park area, which has been recently developed, is it's fairly high density, but because everything is on street level, that just creates this intensity and overwhelming traffic.
You know, that area is interesting because historically that part of SoMa, south of Market near the ballpark, was mostly industrial and warehouse space. It wasn't really a place where people lived. Only I would say since the 90s, especially during the first dot-com boom in the late 90s, is when tech companies started moving in, new condo developments started being built, The Giants Stadium was built, and it started bringing more people, which eventually brought more congestion. But I remember going to that part of town when I was a kid in the 80s, and it was a ghost town. It was also scary. It was not a place you wanted to be at night.
I know with the rail tracks at the Caltrans station, eventually they're going to move that up to the Transbay Terminal, but there's some plan for some massive redevelopment for that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So the Caltrain tracks, which currently end at 4th and King, which is just a block or two away from the Giants Stadium, that will probably be prime land for development. And the city of San Francisco right now is going through a rezoning of the area known as Central SoMa. So right around that area, 4th, 5th, 6th streets. Most of the development on this boom cycle has been focused around the Transbay area and the transit center. But I would say the next cycle, the development is going to be focused in the Central SoMa area. And there's been a lot of debate within San Francisco political and development circles about the city's plan, because they started the process almost a decade ago. And at that point, the city was still trying to get jobs to the city, so it zoned for a lot more office development. But now with the housing crisis, there's been a huge push for zoning for more housing density, which I think is a good idea. But, you know, the city is still incentivized to build office development because they make more money from the business taxes rather than developing residential units.
And yeah, and housing is the, I mean, that's really the crucial issue because of the housing crisis. But I was looking at the Central SoMa plan. This seems like the height increase is fairly modest, so maybe like they're allowing for 15 to 20 story buildings. You would think
yeah.
The new that central subway line, and it's fairly close to BART, like that area you'd think would be prime for at least 50, like 40, 50, or even 60-story buildings.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I'm not sure why they're not going higher. I think there'll be a few parcels of land that are zoned for higher, but it's parcel by parcel. Yeah, but I think on average, you're right, it's kind of mid-height, not super high-rise, but middle.
There is some planned high-rise development near the, I think it's the old Chronicle building in that general area, but I forget the name of it.
Yeah, there's a huge development that's planned for that area called 5M.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And that's been in the works for years. Again, just negotiating with neighborhood groups and getting the inclusionary housing right. Actually, I think In that case, it's a huge mixed-use development that includes office and residential, and they were able to offer more affordable housing units in that project because of the office development, which will offset the cost to build that affordable housing.
So, yeah, I did visit Ghirardelli Square and the Cannery, and I mean, I know those are really touristy places, but there's still some of my favorite places to visit. And kind of that whole theme of like the courtyards and the different layers, like that urban oasis. But I also like how they kind of the old Victorian era industrial buildings, and they have those kind of mid-century modern additions. So Ghirardelli Square, I like how they add all these different, a lot of the lamp posts are very mid-century modern. And I've also heard that the Cannery was at the very, I mean, that actually that external glass elevator was featured in Dirty Harry, but I read somewhere that was actually the very first external glass elevator in the country.
Oh, I did not know that. That's very interesting. I mean, both the Cannery and the Ghirardelli Square are pleasant spaces. It's just the programming and, you know, they're just tourist areas, but the buildings themselves are really nice, and the play of outdoor-indoor is really nice there as well.
Matt, we went to the Rodeo Collection in Beverly Hills. Do you think
yes.
It's possible that that complex was influenced by the Cannery and Ghirardelli?
Well, it certainly the external glass elevator at the Cannery certainly, or rather, the external glass elevator at the Rodeo Collection certainly resembles the one at the Cannery. So who knows if it was directly based on it? Yeah, the brick as well.
Adam, have you been to the Rodeo Collection?
No, is that a? I've been to Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. Is that nearby?
Yeah, it's on Rodeo Drive. It's a very small mall, basically. The entrance isn't super clear. It's just kind of like a, almost looks like an alley, and you go in, and it's this kind of self-contained little this very self-contained space that has just like a few shops.
I think I've been there before. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's kind of retro-futuristic, but you can kind of pick up. It's definitely inspired by a lot of. I mean, I'm pretty sure it is inspired by places like the Cannery.
Yeah, it's funny to me that Beverly Hills is actually one of the walkable areas of LA. I always got a kick out of that.
It's probably one of the most walkable.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it has such. I mean, Beverly Hills is so synonymous with crafts materialism. I mean, that's definitely true. You can't dispute that. But there's also so many architectural gems.
Yeah, there's a lot of beautiful houses and even multifamily buildings in Beverly Hills. I think south of is it Santa Monica Boulevard or Wilshire Boulevard?
Oh yeah, those are the smaller homes that are more like Spanish bungalows.
Yeah, I know that's considered, I guess, the hood of Beverly Hills, but actually there's a lot of nice smaller homes in that part of the town.
And then in San Francisco, we did visit the new Transbay terminal.
Which closed 2 days after we were there.
Oh, right, yeah, it did.
And it's still closed.
Why did it close?
They found some cracks in these huge beams that span over the roadway.
Oh, my God. It was a new construction that they found problems with, basically.
Brand new construction, yeah.
So you guys are lucky that you got to see it, maybe.
Yeah. So the actual the bus terminal is closed. The rooftop park is closed until further notice. There is no date on when that's going to open back up.
Oh, shoot. Did someone probably lost their job over that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it's... people are being overly cautious or if it's really an issue, but the San Francisco Chronicle interviewed some or asked some structural engineers for their take, and it seems to be pretty serious.
Wow.
I mean, I did enjoy walking around there and exploring, especially the park, but it just doesn't have the feeling of like those grand atriums, whether they're the more traditional train stations like Grand Central Terminal. But even though there was that proposal by Soame, which would have this magnificent atrium. Yeah, I really wanted to see that one get built. But as far as newer train stations go, I guess one of my favorite is the... I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the new train station in Vienna?
No, I don't know about that one.
But the thing about it is, I did enjoy visiting there, but it doesn't have that really, like, grand feeling that you would get when you walk into those giant atriums.
Yeah, you're talking about Transbay?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think about the rooftop park?
I would say, from a practical standpoint, I enjoyed walking around there because more so because of the view looking out, but the aesthetics of the Transbay itself didn't really impress me, but it's more just the overall experience of... It was very pleasant having the garden there and being able to look out at the high-rises and the view. So it's more just I would say kind of the practical elements, and it is connected to these other high-rises by walkways. So those are most of the ones that were built during the tech boom when there were economic incentives for tech companies to move to the city.
Right, right. And a lot of those buildings you see from the park up there are pretty recently built high-rises. I agree. The view, I like it just because it gives you a different perspective on the city, which was nice to see.
Yeah, that's definitely the strong point. So, I've been following sites like Socket Site for San Francisco, and it's basically the same with Urbanize LA for LA. I've noticed a massive slowdown in new high-rise proposals.
Yeah, I think we're coming to the end of the boom cycle here.
Do you have thoughts why that is?
I think it's probably several factors. I think we're just exhausted ourselves on this cycle. I think there's a lot of bubbling up happening with some of the tech companies that are way overvalued and are not producing the results that investors expect. I also think partly has to do with the federal government and what Trump is doing with regard to tariffs, especially with China. It's just hard to know at this point exactly when things are going to fall, but there's definitely a feeling in the air that a slowdown is coming. Whether that manifests itself in the form of like a crash like in 2008 or just kind of a soft deflation, I'm not sure. I'm hoping it's the latter because it'll do less damage. But regardless, I do think we are headed for a slowdown.
As far as the newer high-rises go, do you have a favorite? I guess I would say the 181 Fremont.
Yeah, 181 Fremont's pretty nice. There's a new tower by Rem Koolhaas OMA, which is a Dutch firm. It was for a developer called Related. And I think it's mixed use. I think it's part condos, part office, and it's a pretty simple form, but it's got a really nice glass facade curtain wall that reflects the light really nicely. I was just looking into the other night on the sunset. You could see the actual reflection of the clouds with the sun reflecting on the clouds, and you could see the reflection of the cloud with the sun on the facade. It was really cool to see.
Oh yeah, I think I know the one you're talking about.
I think you could see it from the park, the Transbay Park.
Oh yeah, I think I know the one. Yeah. I actually like the turquoise Intercontinental Hotel, but for some reason a lot of people don't like that.
That always gets that along with the Marriott Marquis, the Jukebox always get voted the ugliest buildings in San Francisco.
Really, those are my two. Obviously, they're not my favorite, but they're my favorite one. I would say my favorite buildings built after 1980 in South of Market. So I like the Intercontinental and the Marriott Jukebox probably much more so than a lot of the stuff in South of Market, because what's interesting about the Marriott Jukebox is you see that kind of a Art Deco influence, and there's a number of other 80s high-rises that have that Deco influence.
I can see the allure of the Marriott Jukebox. It's kind of interesting. It's a little bit clunky. There's actually a cool rooftop bar with nice views, but I just don't see anything redeeming about the Intercontinental. It's just
Matt, did you see the? I think you took a picture of that Marriott.
Yeah, the Jukebox. I did not see this Intercontinental. I'm trying to get a picture of that online right now. But my take on the Jukebox was that I liked it. To me it seemed very 80s in a way that I liked. But I also could totally see why a lot of people, again, including my friend and travel companion, really disliked it.
Yeah, people, for some reason, people like to bash on 80s architecture. I mean, I also really like the Crocker Galleria. I mean, just for the aesthetics, but also that kind of urban oasis theme. But you can definitely, it's this kind of 80s postmodernism, because you can see the influence from a lot of those European-style shopping arcades. I mean, I really like the Crocker Galleria, but that's another building that a lot of architecture critics like to bash.
It's another one of those places that's very active with the work crowd, the Monday through Friday crowd, and personally I'm not a huge fan of it as much as Robert is, but it is not such a bad place to go grab lunch, or on Thursdays they actually have, Thursday afternoons, that they have a farmer's market there, which is it's pretty successful. So as a space, it's successful because it's used and there's businesses there and things are happening, but snobby architects like myself kind of thumb our noses at it a bit.
Yeah, well, I gotta say, I'm looking up the Intercontinental now, and I kind of like it too.
Really, with the glass?
Well, I'm looking at the right thing. With the glass, yeah, the kind of triangular.
I think like, that must be it.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like it.
But yeah, I just Google image searched. I mean, some of the images actually look nicer than the building itself.
I can see that, yeah.
And San Francisco has some great mid-century modern high-rises. When it comes to mid-century modern, there is the focus primarily on the single-family homes, which are fantastic. But as far as high-rises go, you have that Bay Area architect, Eichler, who designed a lot of homes in the suburbs, single-family homes.
Right.
But Eichler designed a number of high-rises on Russian Hill. And then there's that Fairmont Hotel Tower where... that's where the Tonga Room is, which is a great place, but... I mean, I really like those high-rises from the 60s. Especially the residential... a lot of the residential ones on Nob Hill and Russian Hill.
Yeah, some of those are pretty interesting, I gotta say. I'm not exactly sure how those were approved. There was no way in hell that a high-rise on Nob Hill or Russian Hill would be approved in this day and age, but I think it's cool that... even when you look out on the bay, you can look at those high rises and get a frame of reference of what you're looking at. Oh, I'm looking at Nob Hill. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, mid-century modern is appreciated for single-family homes, but I'm not as sure as high rises. I really like those. Even the 70s era high rises. Well, there's the one behind the St. Francis, and then there's that one further west on west of Union Square, which I forget the name of that hotel.
Oh, the Hilton.
The one that was responsible for the height limit.
Yeah, the Hilton.
You were saying, why was there a height limit? Because, I mean, I really like that building, but it was because some people viewed it as eyesore. I mean, I really like it.
Well, they viewed it, it was a little bit too close to the Tenderloin.
Oh, right.
So there were a lot of activists who saw that the Union Square tourist zone was slowly creeping west into the Tenderloin. And after the Hilton Tower was built, there was a huge backlash against high-rise, and that whole area got downzoned.
I really like that area around, what's its, I think, is it, I would think it's, is it Mason? I forget. But right where the Union, right where Union Square and the Tenderloin meet, kind of near the JW Marriott, because it's the right balance between trendy and seedy.
Yeah, that's my favorite area of the city, and that's where I've lived most of my time in San Francisco. It's kind of known as the Tender Knob because it's the area when you're coming on the south side of Nob Hill that flows into the Tenderloin. But yeah, the streets around there are like Sutter Street, Post Street, Mason, Taylor, that area.
And then, it gets a lot worse the further south and east you go. You were telling me you went to one of those SF neon tours, what you discovered from the show?
Yeah, I did, actually. They were great. Randall Land and Al Barna, they're great people. They actually just recently got a grant from the city to invest in historical neon sign rehabilitation in the Tenderloin. And I did the Tender Knob tour with them, and it was just really awesome because I got to see my neighborhood where I've lived for years in a totally new light. And literally and figuratively, and they just have a very deep knowledge of neon history, not only in San Francisco but internationally. But I highly suggest both of you guys, when you come back to San Francisco, sign up for one of their tours because you'll love it.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. They have some good tour. I think there's some neon tours in LA too that I've also been meaning to go on.
Oh yeah, for sure. And the Neon Museum in Glendale. I haven't been there yet, but
yeah, I have been there. Very, very nice.
Oh yeah, I definitely want to go. So with San Francisco, I think it was from the show. San Francisco has the highest concentration of neon outside of Vegas.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think that could be right.
I mean, most of it is. I think the highest concentration is probably the Tenderloin. Also, around Union Square, Nob Hill. I mean, because it's really great how in Union Square, how they preserved all these older signs from hotels and businesses, because I've heard in New York, like most of that stuff, it's just basically all gone.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because even though, I guess, proportionally to other cities in the U.S., San Francisco has a good number of neon signs, but on the neon tour, they showed an image of Market Street, the mid-market area, from the 1950s, and it was just exponentially more neon everywhere. It was just amazing, the photo they showed. And I guess what happened was that when they built the BART under Market Street, a lot of the businesses actually went out of business due to the construction, and with the businesses going away, so did the neon signs, and they never came back. So I thought that was kind of a tragedy.
Yeah, for sure. And there was some proposal for a mid-market sign district that got voted down.
Yeah, I don't know much about that, but sounds like it might have not been the right decision.
There's also some great Art Deco high rises there. Let's see. There's the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, which also has a great neon sign. Well, it's the one for the Starlight Lounge, which I don't. It's actually been shut down for a while. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. But as far as Art Deco high rises, there's that one. Well, there's the. Let's see. There's a Shell building, which has that beautiful gold shell in the lobby. The lobby area. There's that high rise in South of Market. And then there's a couple Art Deco high rises on. Well, actually, both Russian Hill and Knob Hill. There's one on the top of Knob Hill, which is a really notable with a spire on top. But it is really.
Are you talking about the Mark Hopkins Hotel?
Oh, there's a Mark Hopkins, and then there's another one that's probably a residential building. The thing is, I mean, those are all really great buildings, but they're because of the height limits due to earthquake. It's really, I mean, it is kind of a shame that the city doesn't have anything significantly taller that really stands out.
I mean, I guess you could argue now that, I mean, it's not an Art Deco building, but the Salesforce Tower definitely stands out. You can see it from almost any vantage point in the city now.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But with Art Deco, most of the buildings...
Well, there's that one we saw from the Transbay Park, which is
right.
the old Pac Bell building in SoMa, and now it's Yelp's headquarters, the tech company Yelp.
Oh, yeah. And the ones on... And the ones on Knob Hill, they stand out because they're...
Yeah, they're on a hill.
The hill, yeah. And then we also visited the Palace Hotel, which is featured in that Michael Douglas film, The Game.
Right, what do you think about that space when you walk in there?
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely something really otherworldly about it. I mean, not just the atmosphere, but just the kind of intricacy of the design, the gilding, the atrium. Would you say that is Beaux-Arts?
Definitely. Yeah, I was actually reading the history about it after we went there, and I think it was originally built in 1875, but it burned down in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake fire, then it was rebuilt in 1909. So the one we went to was built in 1909. So it's one of the older buildings in San Francisco right now, and it's pretty magnificent. From the outside, it's kind of nondescript, you wouldn't know, but then you go inside and you have that atrium space, and it's pretty fantastic.
And we also checked out the Neiman Marcus. That was originally an old department store called City of Paris, and now they have the original atrium from the old store with a more kind of 80s look. I'm not 100% sure. I think that was designed by Philip Johnson. I mean, I personally really like the contrast of the 80s design with the original. That I really love that contrast, but I know at the time a lot of people were upset about that.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting you took me in there, Robert, because I didn't realize they had that beautiful ceiling in there. But I did talk to some San Francisco architectural historian buffs after going there, and pretty unanimously, the historian community in San Francisco thinks it was an architectural crime what Philip Johnson did there.
And Philip Johnson did design another high rise in the financial district.
Yeah, 101 California. It's kind of this cylindrical, strange building. Did we walk by there? It has those...
Oh, we did, right.
Yeah, I think we did, yeah.
So the trend, so there was a kind of modernist era, and then there was a postmodernism in the 80s and 90s, and then a shift back to modernism. What do you see as the next trends in architecture? Do you see a return to postmodernism? Because one thing I have noticed is an interest in reviving older designs. So in the 80s, there was this kind of as with the Marriott jukebox, there was this kind of interest in some aspects of Art Deco. This new trend I see is new skyscrapers or high-rises that are emulating mid-century modern. Have you noticed that?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by emulating mid-century modern. I mean, a lot of the high-rises that are going up today are pretty simple in form and massing and have usually a pretty clean curtain wall. I actually think there might be a renewed interest in postmodernism with the understanding that we don't want to make the same mistakes with going overboard with historical references, but perhaps we see kind of a marriage between modernism and postmodernism. Who knows? Maybe maybe we look, you know, even some projects I'm working on now, we're kind of looking back at Art Deco style, not to copy it verbatim, but for inspiration on how we can add visual interest and texture, and I hate to use the word, but decoration to new buildings.
Yeah, that would be really great to see that trend.
I've heard, I think that would be called to be metamodernism, which I've heard in reference
right.
Literary theory, but I guess the idea being a marriage of modernism and postmodernism. Again, I've heard it in reference to like literary theory and literature, but I guess
that's interesting.
The same thing would that'd probably be the label for architecture too. It's interesting.
God, I got to look into that because I definitely see that architecture is trending that way. Absolutely, I didn't know there was a term for it, but I mean, postmodernism definitely followed literary theory in architecture.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's ever been applied to architecture, but it seems like that would, it would make sense that that label would follow it there too, just because it's kind of a synthesis between modernism and postmodernism.
Yeah.
We were kind of talking about themes relating to the housing crisis and aesthetics, and then also historic preservation. But one thing that is important to point out is most of the areas that have the most the architecture that is the most worth preserving, the most historic, the most aesthetic values, places like Knob Hill, Union Square, North Beach, and even places like Marina District, which are smaller scale but still relatively dense. Those are areas that have a lot of charm but are fairly dense. The areas that are lower density, such as the Sunset, those are the areas that are more bland architecturally.
Yeah, I mean, most of those were developed post-World War II boom, and the Sunset District's primarily single-family homes and not the most aesthetically pleasing. Some people find value in the aesthetics of it out there. I don't really see it. And whenever YIMBYs or local politicians talk about wanting to densify the west and south sides of the city, there's always a huge outcry, because the people that live out there are used to this more suburban lifestyle, and I think they see themselves as distinctly separate from the downtown eastern parts of the city.
I think it's really important to use aesthetics to bridge the divide between YIMBYs and NIMBYs, because there's just some people you're not going to win over. They're just flat out hostile to any increase in density. But if you do put up better aesthetic visions, I think you can win over a lot of skeptics or people who are kind of on the fence.
Yeah, I mean, to a lot of the NIMBYs who have objections over aesthetics, I don't necessarily blame them. There has been a lot of new high-density mixed-use buildings, and I'm talking mostly about 5-6-story kind of boxy condominium and apartment buildings that have been built in the Bay Area, and also you see them around LA too, are just not very inspiring architecturally. On the one hand, I understand we need more housing. We need to build more housing faster because there's a housing crisis. But at the same time, I wish there was more attention paid to aesthetics. And I, as an architect, I can't really blame my colleagues in the profession, because there are so many rules to deal with when you're building designing a new building, in terms of the zoning laws, responding to neighborhood concerns, and designs, even if they had a great aesthetic vision from the outset of the design process, they end up getting watered down through bureaucratic red tape and other things like, you know, developer finances and that sort of thing. So it's kind of a shame. And this is kind of going back to the Portman discussion, is that he was his own client, so he was able to push the limits aesthetically, and it's hard to see that these days.
Yeah, it would be great if architects were given more power over the design process, but that's probably not going to happen.
No, I mean, there's a small handful of architects I'm aware of that are starting to take things into their own hands. There's one architect in San Diego named Jonathan Siegel, and he actually has a web series called Architect as Developer, and he's been very successful in San Diego developing his own buildings, and they're really nice. They're modernist buildings, and he's been very financially successful with his projects. I just think architects too, we get so mired down in the details so easily, because there's so many facets to designing a building, that thinking about the financing part and the business side of it, it's something we're not really equipped to do, unfortunately.
Matt, you also, in your trip, you stayed out in some of the more suburban areas or further out.
Yeah, that's right. I stayed in Alamo and near Danville, which was really nice. Even the suburbs. I'm not like a huge suburban fan, but even the suburbs in the Bay Area, you know, Danville, Walnut Creek, Alamo, where I was, really nice houses. And
what is interesting about those places, like Danville and Los Gatos, where Adam grew up, they're different than your generic post-war suburb in the sense that they actually started out as actual small towns in the 19th century.
Yeah, and I think that you can still kind of see that. They still feel like small towns, even, like, you know, very near to, like, nature, very near to green spaces. They have that feeling, which is really unique. Again, I lived in the suburbs of Philadelphia for some time growing up, too, and, I mean, that's just... not to totally diss that or whatever, but just, you know, it's just suburban sprawl, and that's what it feels like, but different in the Bay Area.
And I guess a lot of the YIMBY activists would, I mean, they would view a lot of those wealthier people who live in those areas as kind of selfish to have all that land to themselves. And I kind of get where they're coming from, but the thing is, even if you can't afford to live in a place like that, it is nice to have a place where you can kind of escape the density of the city and go out and feel like you're in a small town. So, and also just the massive amounts of open space. Just not, I mean, there's Marin County, there's the green belts between San Francisco and the Silicon Valley around Palo Alto, and then the East Bay is just massive amounts of wilderness between. Basically, like, from Berkeley to Walnut Creek, there's a lot of open space around there. And then I also went up to Mount Diablo, and Matt did, too. So it is... Mm-hmm. I mean, you do go out to some of those places, and you do feel like you're out in the country. And it is really, like... I remember that one day I went up to Mount Diablo, and then I also went to San Francisco. Like, being able to be in the wilderness and the city in one day is a really amazing experience. So... that contrast is what makes the region really great. But I mean, I think there are solutions that can address both concerns. So you could build these kind of more village-like structures in the suburbs that accommodate more housing, but they also kind of capture that charm. I think that could be done if there were revisions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, YIMBYs tend to blame the restrictive zoning in these pleasant suburban towns around the Bay Area, and that's definitely true, but I understand the value, and one of the allures of the Bay Area is this access to nature, being so close by the urban areas. And my solution to that is to just densify the already urban or semi-urban areas even more, which is, I mean, I'm a proponent of densifying the west side of San Francisco because it's very well served by transit. And even Oakland as well. There's still so many empty lots that can be developed in places like Oakland or even Alameda or south of San Francisco, like Daly City or South San Francisco or Brisbane. I mean, there's just a lot of opportunity to build denser, closer to the already dense parts of the Bay Area without spoiling the nice areas just outside the urban area.
And yeah, and those are really kind of far out places like Marin County and Danville. I mean, it would ruin building a bunch of condos there. Would ruin the kind of semi-rural. It would ruin the kind of feeling that you're out in the country. But just from a practical standpoint, those areas don't have the traffic, the infrastructure to handle all that traffic. So it makes more sense to focus on places, as you said. I mean, just think about like places like Daly City, where you have massive parking lots around the BART station, or downtown places like downtown Fremont, downtown Oakland, Emeryville. Those kind of more semi-urban to inner ring suburbs. I mean, those are the places that can handle a lot more development. But as far as the more far-out places that are more semi-rural, they can't really accommodate that.
Right, and I think we talked about this last time I was on your show, Robert, was San Francisco State Senator Scott Wiener had a bill SB 827, which got killed actually in the state Senate, which was going to upzone areas within a certain distance of like public transit routes throughout the state. And in on one hand, you have the old time NIMBYs opposing that, but you also had a lot of anti-gentrification activists opposing it, which is I think what killed it. And a lot of those came from LA, like South LA and like Boyle Heights and East LA. And I don't know if you guys have more your finger on the pulse of what exactly that was about, but in lower income areas that are well served by transit, any new development is seen as kind of an invasion, and gentrification fears get stoked by activists. And I feel like that's another issue that is really in the way of going full speed ahead on a density program in the Bay Area and also in LA. I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that.
I don't know that much about it, but I do know that there's a lot of anti-gentrification activism, especially in East LA and Boyle Heights.
And yeah, I mean, those are just looking at the context of LA right now, Culver City is rapidly gentrifying and going from a working class community to a more upscale community, but a lot of that has to do is because Santa Monica and Beverly Hills restrict housing. So if Beverly Hills was willing to build a lot of luxury high-rises in their downtown area, and same with Santa Monica, that would ease the demand for single-family homes in more middle-income areas like Westchester.
Yeah, no, that's interesting.
And I mean, the same applies to the Bay Area as well. And I think our last show we did touch upon, you mentioned Santa Cruz, we didn't really get a chance to talk about Santa Cruz, but it's interesting comparing Santa Cruz to where I live in Santa Barbara. So outside of downtown Santa Cruz, it is primarily single-family homes, but because it was most of it was built either they're Victorians or craftsmen's homes, so they're single-family homes. But it's extremely compact and walkable. With Santa Barbara, because it was built in the post-war era, Santa Barbara feels much more suburban than outside of downtown. So Santa Cruz, even though it's single-family homes, it is extremely walkable.
Yeah, it's downtown Santa Cruz, and especially the areas immediately adjacent to downtown Santa Cruz, are fairly dense and pretty walkable. I actually am a big fan of all those towns along the central coast, from Santa Cruz to Monterey and Carmel, to Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara. I think these are great places. I love going here. I think the reason they don't have the same, they haven't been subject to the same pressures, is because they don't have as much of an economic base, say, as like LA or San Francisco. So they've been able to retain a lot of their charm. But I know real estate's not cheap, obviously. Like, Santa Cruz has definitely been impacted by the boom in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, Santa Cruz definitely has a lot of people who commute to Silicon Valley. So what makes kind of this region, what is remarkable about the region is just the extreme kind of contrasts in experiences from basically you can be in a wilderness area that where you feel very remote to kind of extreme urbanism. I mean, LA does have some remarkable urban areas, and there are great places to hike, like the Santa Monica Mountains, but you don't get the same like intensity and extremes.
That's true. I mean, I think I mentioned before, I used to live in Los Feliz, part of LA. I loved it because I could walk and go hiking in Griffith Park, but I could also walk to the Red Line station and be in downtown or Koreatown in 10 minutes, which I loved. But I know that's kind of a unique experience, but I definitely chose that area for a reason, to have that experience.
Yeah, I guess there are parts of LA that also kind of fit that same bill as San Francisco, where there are very natural areas, you know, within the middle of the city or within the middle of a county at least. But there's just less of a kind of cohesive through line of that in LA that there is in the Bay Area.
And I just remember that we took that trip up to Big Bear, Lake Arrowhead, and Joshua Tree.
Yeah.
I just remember that drive back. We drove for the Coachella Valley, like basically 2 hours and nothing but sprawl.
Yeah, yeah.
That whole model in what they call the Inland Empire of suburban development is, it's fascinating and also grotesque to me simultaneously. Like driving on, were you guys driving on the 10?
Yeah, through the 10 West.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. You just go through like Rancho Cucamonga and these places and San Bernardino, and there's just really, it's not, I think those are going to, I have a prediction as people move back to the city, those are going to be the new ghettos.
Oh, for sure. And the thing is, a lot of sprawl apologists will say that, oh, we need to develop this open space because we need to ease the housing shortage. But Orange County is a place that followed that sprawl model. Now Orange County is insanely expensive, so I mean there are better ways to do things. That's not sustainable.
No, it's not sustainable at all, and I think historians of urbanism are going to look back at that post-World War II time and think that was a pretty big mistake.
And just to kind of summarize this show, I think the key to finding a kind of creating a cohesive message and finding more common ground between people who between the YIMBY movement, the people who fetishize suburbia, and the people who are skeptical of development, those three groups, is to create aesthetic visions that basically, I mean, they're aesthetically pleasing, they incorporate open space, and just kind of create the kind of communities that people would want to live in. And they can be places either that are very dense and urban, or they can be more kind of village-like structures, but and also more of a diversity of aesthetics. So I think, I mean, that is a key to attracting people to your ideas.
Yeah, that's why I think densifying single-family neighborhoods in like inner-ring suburbs or places like the west side of San Francisco, and not building high-rises, but just allowing missing middle housing on single-family lots. I think you can do that tastefully, and you can add a lot more housing, and you can still preserve open space. I just hope that as a culture, we can talk more about this kind of approach.
Adam Mayer, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, guys. Great to chat with you both.